This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Young Wealth Show, where you'll truly learn how to make, spend, and invest money for an awesome life. Get the real-life stuff that wasn't part of your school curriculum. Young Wealth gives you innovative new ways of dealing with your finances, as well as the skills and tools you're going to need to survive and be successful out on your own. Let the Young Wealth Show be your GPS to take you from clueless to clued in. Here's your host, Jason Hartman, with Young Wealth.
It's my pleasure to welcome William Poundstone. He is the author of the New York Times best-selling books, Fortune's Formula, The Untold Story of Scientific Betting System That Beat the Casinos and Wall Street, and Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It, Gaming the Vote, Why Elections Aren't Fair, and What We Can Do About It, Rock, Break, Scissors, A Practical Guide to Outguessing and Outwitting Almost Everybody, and the new book, Head in the Cloud, Why Knowing Things Still Matters When Facts Are So Easy to Look Up. William, welcome. How are you?
Yes, I'm very good. Good to be with you.
Good. It's good to have you on the show. You've got a fantastic body of work, and your latest work is Head in the Cloud. You know, we do. We live in this information era, obviously, and we have lived in that for, several decades now. But is there a difference between being able to look things up and, you know, what we actually know without looking it up? And then, of course, there's the debate of what's the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Information isn't everything. You've got to know how to use it, right? Kind of dive into that and tell us about the premise here.
Yeah, well, that's very definitely the sort of questions I began with here. It is so easy to look up any fact. We kind of take that for granted now, but it is an amazing thing, and it definitely does change our whole relationship to knowledge. I mean, educators are confronting that. What things is it important to teach kids nowadays? And there are people who say, you know, we don't have to teach people to memorize the capitals of countries. I mean, you should know the capital of France, but you shouldn't necessarily have to know the capital of Colombia or something like that. So what I did is I kind of took a big data approach. I did a series of surveys where I really looked at what the American public actually knows in all sorts of fields, from quantum physics to pop culture. And then I looked at how that correlated with everything from behavior to political beliefs, to how much money you make, how happy you say you are, and looked at what types of knowledge really did seem to matter in the real world. So that's really the jumping off point with this, and I found that there were a lot of interesting correlations. One of them was just that knowing what you might call trivia knowledge, and I mean, you know, the kind of stuff you might see on Jeopardy or in Trivial Pursuit, just general knowledge of facts that don't seem to matter a whole lot, like, you know, state capitals or something like that. But actually, these do have a correlation with how much money people make. The people who know more facts tend to make more money. This isn't unusual in itself because you figure, well, they're more educated, and if you have a college degree, you'll earn more money. But even when you factor that out, you still find that among people of a certain educational level, the ones who know more trivia facts tend to make more money. They tend to report themselves as healthier and happier. So this implies that there is, you know, something we should really pay attention to there, that there are values to having facts in your head and not just out there in the cloud.
Well, what do we do with these facts? I mean, you know, is it just the ability to use them quickly? I mean, certainly if you go on Jeopardy and, you know, I mean, that's helpful, but we're all connected all the time. I mean, tell us what matters. Or is it really because we create, you know, maybe on the more scientific side, new neural pathways and just expands our brain? And that's, you know, certainly why it's important to know stuff, because our brain, like any muscle, gets stronger with use, I suppose, right?
One of the analogies I talk about in the book is that you can make an argument that because we've got, you know, Uber and Segways and all these different ways of getting around, that you don't have to walk anymore. But obviously, you do have to do that just to get exercise And similarly, your brain needs some exercise. Even if you can look up facts, it's helpful throughout your life to be learning new facts. But I suspect there's an even better reason than that for it, and that knowing sort of a general knowledge of baseline facts gives you a sort of the gift of humility. It helps you to appreciate what you don't know, which does a number of things. For one thing, it makes it easier for you to look up stuff on the internet, because unless you can come up with a good search term and have a sense of what it is you don't know, it's very hard to look up stuff on the internet. And another thing is an amazing phenomenon I talk about in the book called the Dunning-Kruger effect. Mm-hmm. Now, this is named for two Cornell psychologists, David Dunning and Justin Kruger, who realized that the people who are either very ignorant or very unskilled in something tend to have an exaggerated notion of how good they are.
I couldn't agree more. The know-it-all is yes. Kind of the person who doesn't really know too much.
You know? Yes. Yeah. As Dunning told me, the overconfident airhead is someone we've all met and often someone we work with. He actually came across this by reading a story about like one of these world's dumbest criminals. This guy was a bank robber. He robbed two Pittsburgh banks in broad daylight. He did not wear a mask. And of course, the video cameras caught his face. He was very quickly arrested. But when the police arrested him, he was amazed because he said he had worn lemon juice on his face. And his reasoning was that he had read that wearing lemon juice is used as invisible ink. So he figured if he put it on his face, he would be invisible to the cameras. So obviously this guy did not appreciate how much he didn't know. He thought he would be a good bank robber, but actually he was totally incompetent at it. And that became like the crystallizing example for this Dunning-Kruger effect. Of course, you see it all around us. And really, the only thing you can do to avoid being in that position is to have a kind of baseline of contextual knowledge. Know a little bit about everything, because that's a good way of getting some sense of what you don't know.
You know, Bill, one of the areas that I think this, I've always thought that the intelligence is largely dictated, and not just intelligence, but our ability to find information, as you so appropriately mentioned about searching online, is dictated by our vocabulary. Mm-hmm. Because the larger our vocabulary, the larger our ability to think. If we can't, if we don't have a word for something, it really makes it hard to understand. And I've always been kind of fascinated, although I'm not a linguist and I don't know much about different languages and I barely speak much Spanish. When I travel, I just always think it's more important to learn about history and economics than it is to try and learn the language. You know, you never have time to do that. But, you know, some languages don't have words for things, including English. Mm-hmm. But English is really one of the richest languages in the world because it takes from so many other languages, of course. But many languages don't have words to express certain scientific concepts. And those people speaking those languages are very handicapped, I would think. I mean, this is kind of my own hypothesis here, so I may be totally wrong, but it's just an idea I've always had.
You're absolutely right, and you do find a big connection between people's vocabulary and various measures of how well they get on in the world. In fact, in ancient Greece, I think they had just a few words for colors. They didn't have a word for green. And that completely changes how you look at the world. I mean, obviously, they saw green leaves, but it wasn't something that they could really put a color name to. So it really does affect how you think. It's a pretty important thing. One of the more amusing things I found was not just vocabulary, but how you pronounce words. There are people who mispronounce fairly common words in business meetings, like niche. A lot of people say niche. And I did a survey where I asked people, you know, how do you pronounce these words? It was multiple choice. And I found that there was a huge correlation between how good you were at pronouncing words and how much money you make.
And don't forget grammar, but that's another subject. That if you want to sound like an idiot, just have bad grammar. Yeah. And, you know, bad table manners won't help you much either. So both of those things, yeah.
Yeah, and of course, Facebook teaches everyone that their friends don't know grammar.
My God, that's the understatement of the century. And they don't know the difference between Y-O-U apostrophe R-E and Y-O-U-R.
Yes.
or the different types of twos. Or, you know, we could go on and on, but let's not. So that's all very interesting. You know, one of the beginning chapters in your book, when you talk about Dunning-Kruger effect, is the map of ignorance. I mean, take the United States, for example. Are we an ignorant country? There's this sort of European snobbery that goes on in the world that I've noticed quite a bit. And I happen to have grown up in the U.S., but was born in Europe, have been back many times, and I think Europe is highly overrated, actually. They're the victim of socialism and political correctness, unfortunately, and it's a terrible problem over there. It's coming to the U.S., but not as bad yet.
Yeah.
But, you know, Europeans do know a lot more about world affairs. They do tend to be pretty interesting to talk to. Americans, you know, kind of had it easy, and they're in their own little world, largely. I mean, I think a lot of people would agree with that.
Yeah, exactly.
How do we stack up as a country? And when you look around the country, tell us about this map, if you would.
Well, what I did was ask people, the very common thing, to find a given country on a map. And I did it with a series of surveys where each person had to find 10, you know, countries on a map. And then I collated all that data and made what they call a cartogram, which is one of those distorted maps like you give for like electoral college results or something. But I distorted this map according to what percentage of the American population could not find a given country on a map. So Americans are pretty good at finding America, and so you can see that. But they are really lousy finding countries in Africa. So on this map, you know, Africa looks very distorted, very large. But you'd be surprised, too, aside from a few countries in Europe, like France, England, Germany, Americans really are not good at finding Switzerland, Greece, Austria, you know, countries that really play a big role in history. Now, when I first did this, I thought, okay, Americans are really stupid with maps, that's established. But I did a British version of this book where I wrote a fair amount of new material and conducted surveys with the British public. And I found that the Britons were really just as bad with maps as we are. Now, they were better at finding European countries, but aside from that, they were just as bad as Americans. So I kind of suspect that this tends to be a global phenomenon, that a lot of people just don't get the idea of a map. They don't have this visual, you know, intelligence, a sort of mental image of the world. And that makes it very hard to really understand, you know, how countries relate to the U.S. and to what's going on in the world.
Right. And they kind of know their own neighborhood, I guess, right? Like the Americans know the States a little bit, and and the European, you know, the Brits know the European countries because, you know, you can take a weekend trip to another country in Europe. It's kind of a really cool thing about it. Talk to us about how this interplays with elections a little bit, if you would, or if you have any thoughts on that, and political issues. And so, you know, the country seems so divided now, and the tensions are certainly high.
Yeah.
Any thoughts there?
Yeah, exactly. One of the surveys I asked was just for people to name how many of their elected officials that they could actually name by name. And it's a pretty simple question. You weren't expected to know anything about that official, just what is the name of your congressperson, your two senators. And I found that the median American could name just six of their elected officials. When you consider that the president and vice president were two of those, that's really not very many. And this is scary when you think about, you know, okay, presidential elections get all this publicity, but if you go down the ballot a little, I mean, so much of the business of government is done at the city and state level, and people are pretty much clueless on who the people are representing them. It suggests that when people fill out their ballots for those offices, that at most they're just basing it on a party affiliation. They don't really know much about that particular candidate, what he or she has done, whether there's been any scandals, you know, why they should or shouldn't be voting for that person. So it is kind of a frightening thought there, how little people know. My favorite example in this is the whole idea of voting for judges. Judicial elections are usually nonpartisan. So you've got some names on the ballot. You don't even have a party to adjust who you're going to vote for. And what they've found is that people tend to choose the judge with an American-sounding name. If you have a good, simple name like Smith or Jones or something, people try to vote for them as opposed to someone with a more ethnic name. But I give some examples in the book where the judge with the foreign-sounding name was actually very well qualified, and the American-sounding guy was some sort of crook who got in just for that reason or was totally unqualified. So again, we like to think that voters make these informed decisions, but in so many cases, they really don't.
Right. But in the judge's thing, just to balance that argument out a little bit, it's not just a matter of qualifications or intelligence. It's a matter of partisanship. You know, the voter might think, and I don't know what's going through their head, but they might think something like, well, you know, this judge is not going to vote for the American way. Or, you know, or if I ever have to go in front of that judge, they might be prejudiced against me. There are other thoughts besides just strict qualification, right? You know, the old saying, a good lawyer knows the law and a great lawyer knows the judge.
that's certainly true.
So, you know, it's a matter of maybe relating to that judge to some extent, right? You know, just wanted to throw out another concept there a little bit. But yeah, that's a good point. People don't pay attention to judicial elections much at all, do they?
Unless you're an attorney yourself, people just don't seem to care about that.
And very scarily, in some jurisdictions, attorneys and law firms can donate to judges' campaigns, and that doesn't have to be disclosed in the case.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the judge should obviously be recusing themselves, but in places like Nevada, you know, they can just do whatever they want. It's really mind-boggling. You have a chapter entitled Sex and Absurdity. I just got to ask you about that one because of the title.
Again, it's amazing how little millennials and people in general know about sex education. And I ask, you know, a number of questions like, how many times should an IUD be inserted? And an alarming fraction of the public thinks every time you have sex. So obviously we are failing in some ways to get just basic information to our kids in this.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Are people getting smarter or dumber? Dumbing. I'm reading your chapter, Dumbing Down, When Dumbing Down is Smart. Which direction are we going? Are we at least going in the right direction?
That's a good question, and I'm not even sure that my research can really answer it, because obviously all my surveys were done within a fairly narrow time range. I can say this, though. I mean, if you go back, Socrates complained that people were getting dumber. The younger generation back in archaic Greece was dumber than the older generation. So if that perception had been true, I mean, we have the IQ of a houseplant nowadays, and we're a little better than that. So I think it's just sort of natural in human nature to think, oh, these kids today, they don't know all these things we were taught in school, so they have to be dumb. But I think the reality is that the culture is always changing. I mean, just in science and technology, there are so many things that kids are being taught now that were not taught 20 years ago. It's common to have coding classes in school now. And this was not common, you know, in their parents' time. So you have to, before saying that young people are just getting stupider and stupider, you have to realize that they are learning an awful lot of things that maybe older people never did learn.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. You know, that every generation always laments that the next generation following them has it better. They're so spoiled. They just don't try as hard. They're lazy. They're too liberal. You know, this is a common refrain, right? We've always heard this. The world never moves toward the more conservative side, hardly ever. It always becomes more liberal, if you will. And I'm not saying that in a good or bad way. I'm just making the observation. And it's not necessarily a political way either, but just, you know, liberal ideology about various things. And it always becomes, you know, things in a lot of ways keep getting better. I mean, they're not all better, but it's interesting. Anything you want to share more about health? Or I'd love to hear about scientific betting, too. I know that's a different subject, but just on any of your other work as well before you go.
Well, about the scientific betting thing, that was quite a fun book to work on. It basically started because one of my professors at MIT was Claude Shannon. He wasn't actually teaching much then, but he was this kind of legend there. I should explain, he was the founder of information theory, which is basically behind the internet and our whole digital age today. So he was this incredibly, you know, a real genius, one of the few most brilliant people of the 20th century. But he had basically retired from science, and the story was that he had discovered this scientific betting and investing system. He had made all this money in the stock market, so he decided to just kind of retire from teaching and live his version of the ideal life, which seemed to consist of practicing the oboe and building robots in his basement workshop. And it was said that he got all these dividend checks at his MIT office, but he couldn't even be bothered to come in and cash them. This was an interesting story, so I decided to look into that, and it evolved into this book, Fortune's Formula, that talks about what's known as the Kelly Formula, which is basically this scientific betting system that you can use in all sorts of situations. It's since become very, very popular with a lot of hedge funds, and it kind of ties into all sorts of things about the recent financial system, the various bubbles in the market and everything. So it was just fun telling this human story that really connected to and supplied this wonderful background to so much of the financial news lately.
Very, very interesting. But it just begs the question, if you know the secret to beating the casinos or beating Wall Street, are you doing it? And how's it working for you?
Yeah, exactly. This is really a bet sizing system. If you've got some sort of advantage and you have to get that informational advantage on your own, this tells you the optimal amount that you should be staking on each particular bet or investment in order to increase your wealth at the greatest possible capital growth rate. So it is a bit, you know, wonky and detailed that way. But again, if you're in a situation where you have that advantage, this is really how to maximize it.
Bill, give out your website and tell people where they can find out more about you and your work.
Yes, the website is william-poundstone.com, and you can look up my books on Amazon or pretty much anywhere else, including your brick and mortar bookstore.
Fantastic. William Poundstone, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice, or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.